Welcome to Literary Arts, the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, Executive Director of Literary Arts. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks by the world's best writers for more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. This time, Andrei Codrescu. Born in Romania, Andrei Codrescu emigrated to the United States in 1966. His first book of poetry, License to Carry a Gun, won the Big Table Poetry Award. In 1983, he founded Exquisite Corpse, a journal of books and ideas, and became a regular commentator for NPR's All Things Considered. He later returned to Romania to cover the fall of the Ceaușescu regime for NPR and ABC News. From his experience, he wrote The Hole in the Flag, an exile story of return and revolution. Codrescu is the author of over 40 books, including The Posthumous Dada Guide, Jealous Witness, and Whatever Gets You Through the Night. He is also a screenwriter and received the Peabody Award for his film Rhodes Scholar, which he also starred in. He has taught literature and poetry at Johns Hopkins University, the University of Baltimore, and Louisiana State University, where he is the McCurdy Distinguished Professor of English. Now, from the 2000-2001 season of Portland Arts and Lectures, here is Andrei Codrescu speaking in front of a live audience at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall.
Thank you. I can't tell you how thrilled I am to that you opted out of the Super Bowl of American politics to come here and contribute to the continuing connection between ancient Greece and Portland, which I always thought was here. For some odd reason, when James wrote to me, I thought this makes perfect sense. There was some kind of underground channel. So instead of speaking in complete sentences, which I sometimes do for money, I decided to look at this project as a poetic project, which it is, and write an epic. It lasts 4 days. You know. I know you have the time because you didn't stay home to watch those guys, so it lasts 4 days. It's accompanied by invisible instruments. And it is in honor of the Joy Ram project. And it is entitled A Petite Epic for the Lovejoy Ram. I always found that if you slide a little French word in your titles, things sound better. So it's a petite epic for the Lovejoy Ram, or Eruptions of the Marvelous and Disaster Architecture. The other day on the Nature Channel, I always wanted to start a poem, the other day on the Nature Channel. That being about the only nature some of us get. Nature, a channel among many, actually. You know, next day you got a People Channel and a Disaster Channel. That would be news. The Sci-Fi Channel and the Mystery Channel. So the other day on the Nature Channel, I saw that a perfect ball of iron spewed by the Earth on an island near Madagascar several thousand years ago was hollowed out by a man and his sons who moved inside it and were promptly declared gods by the natives who were allowed inside the ball once a year to get drunk and worship something called Auroch, which was a huge petrified fish that zapped them when they touched it. And for having that experience, they paid the ball carvers in fish, goat meat, grapes, and lizard kebabs. Meanwhile, in Transylvania, my mother, who was in labor, watched a huge bomb fall from the sky and level the Church of the Immaculate Conception, where all our neighbors had taken shelter, and she gave birth to me. While a miraculous plume of smoke drifted upwards and revealed a ruin beneath that was both monstrous and shaped like a baying wolfhound, and she declared it aesthetically pleasing and thanked the Virgin for having delivered her of aesthetics and of an ironic baby. Architecture, like Gaul, is divided into three parts. The part that comes courtesy of the Nature Channel, the part that comes thanks to the war channel, and the part that comes from the imagination channel. And these three architectures, the architecture of nature, the architecture of ruins, and the architecture of the imagination, are the sons of disaster. The ball carver, on the islands near Madagascar, and their mother is my mother, who warned me not to go near ruins when I was a child, but where else could I go? When the whole town was a ruin, and the whole country I lived in was a ruin, and the world I was born into was a ruin, and the school I went to, the elementary school of the Ursulines, renamed the School of the Red Star, was the ruin of a convent under which ran tunnels connecting one ruin to another, tunnels that were also tombs and that had been used in the Middle Ages to escape from invaders into the woods where we were safe in the arms of the nature channel. And the shapes of those ruins were as fantastic as the legends of my people who sank them in the ruins of their hovels to put the world back into some order after the sky and earth gods, the sons of disaster, had their way with the world. So, when I was about 14, I became an expert at making temporary houses in the shadows of cemeteries and crumbling walls, where I took first Marinella, then Aurelia. And there we lived for hours, safe inside each other. And that was the architecture of adolescence, which builds shelters of mystery for the unfolding of its own mysteries. And that, to be perfectly honest, is the only architecture I care for. And I would like to see a collaboration, a collaborative project of urban adolescents from all ages describing the shelters they have made from their desire from the ruins of their cities. What is the eruption of the marvelous, if not the eruption of desire that rearranges the city according to its fancy, knowing that all architecture is born of disaster? Within every building, there is another that can be found only by desire-driven adolescents. Even official buildings of the state and the police where tormented souls wait in endless antechambers under great vaults with trembling forms in their hands. Even there, you'll see a young sergeant or clerk find a secret place to gratify her imagination. And there is no building on earth that has not been rebuilt by the imagination to contain shelter from bright lights, nooks of darkness, chapels of selfhood, chambers and vaults for the song of the Axis Mundi. 1 year after the dictator Ceausescu, you remember him, he was big in Portland for a while. Just like my name, people always say, Mr. Ceausescu. Oh. 1 year after dictator Ceausescu ordered the old center of Bucharest demolished, Byzantine churches and stately homes above all, the coldest winter in the history of the Carpathians froze all the rivers and the lakes, and in the spring when they thawed, an intact 14th century basilica floated down the Danube and headed for the Black Sea, where it sank under the waves, joining Greek triremes and Roman warships and Turkish galleons and Venetian galley ships. And that was the real reason for the revolution and the end of the dictator. When I came to America, I saw history floating by and sinking under the waves of the present. Here, the architectures ruined one another almost as quickly as they rose, having grown up and internalized disaster, their father. In America, all buildings were temporary. Even the post offices and the churches and the museums were artifacts barely recovered from the shock of being moved across oceans, had to move again to a newer building. In America, a child could no longer see the place where she was born. A shopping mall stood there instead. In America, a child could no longer see the school where she learned the art of growing sad. A freeway went through there now, an overpass. Her memories of brick had turned to glass. The suburb went from white to black, and time had speeded up so much she had to stay young forever and reset the clock every 5 minutes just to know where was there, and there was everywhere, because she lived in time and not in any space. The future is in ruins before it is even built. A fact recognized by postmodern architecture that grins shyly or demonically as it quotes ruins from other times and places. There are no buildings in America, only way stations that connect migratory floods, the most permanent architecture being precisely that which moves these floods from one future ruin to another. That is to say, freeways and skyways. And the car is our only shelter, the architecture of desire reduced to the womb, a womb in transit from one nowhere to another. That is one picture, but there are others. In New Mexico, the face of Jesus jumped on a tortilla. In Plaquemines, a virgin projected on a tree. In Santuario de Chimayo, the dirt turned healer. A guy in Texas crashed into a wall when God said, "Let me take the wheel." And others hear voices all the time, telling them to sit under a tree or jump from a cliff or take large baskets of eggs into Blockbusters to throw at the videotapes. The voice of God seems to be everywhere, heard loud and clear under the rumbling of the ticker tape. And all these folk miracles and speaking gods are the mysteries left homeless by the architecture of speed and moving forward, onward, and ahead. Which is not to say that I prefer to wait for others to turn my pad into a ruin. I would rather do it myself, the American way. With a second mortgage and a wrecking crew. That way I can say that I am the author of my own ruin. I always want to say that. And I am, actually. It's amazing. That's the American way, you know. We don't whine or complain. Well, some of us do. But nobody did it to us, so you do it to me and I'll do it to you. Here the rhapsodic epic sort of breaks off and the poet goes to the corner to recover the lyric instrument, but then comes back and starts rhapsodizing again with more water for support. Each building here houses an inner demolition dictator, a household god who chews impatiently his cigar of cash and impatience, and who is not content until everyone is in their cars driving from Nowheresville to Nowheresville in search of therapy and desire. Which brings me to Portland. An intelligent city. That is to say, a city with a plan. Vastly different from the swamp burg of Baton Rouge, where even the gods of demolition have moved out from boredom at being so well worshipped. A city that spreads itself like Houston in the complacency of sprawl and the multiplication of TV channels. So it is Portland we admire, the city with a plan. But is this truly the place where the three architectures of nature, ruins, and imagination meet? Rhetorical question, which is the only way an epic poem moves forward. There's 55 of them in Homer. There is nothing more deadly than a dictator with a utopian blueprint, but blueprints of utopia are blueprints of utopia. In the perfect city, adolescents die of boredom and the lack of complicated architectures that they might transform. At least that was the case in other perfectly planned worlds. Which brings me to the Lovejoy Ramp Project, which aptly named is a serial invocation of ruins and imagination. Below the moving belly of America, a railroad worker named Tom Stephopoulos, a man who stood with a paintbrush that tickled commuters on the road above, who then, not knowing why, were stricken by a desire to masturbate. For years, that stretch of freeway over the Lovejoy ramp was a favorite of drab-wrenched drones. And when the columns were revealed, the Portland Surrealists sighed, "Ah, now we understand." And hastened to save these live-enhancing works, and thus an unfolding drama in three acts. First, the act of revising architecture to the requirements of America by understanding that in the country of freeways, freeways are history. Second, in moving the great pillars with their commuter-tickling powers out of harm's way, they married the heroic to the ludic. And in the third, which has not yet been played, they will transform the decorated legs of the Colossus into a temple that, like the iron ball of Madagascar, awaits only a time to stand so that the citizens might come inside with offerings of pâté de foie gras and nouvelle fusion cuisine to frolic with the poets and vestals of the place. And those three acts fulfill, it seems to me, all the demands of nature, ruins, and imagination. And thus, as in a placid lake that lies within its planted warp and woof, even as rents are going through the roof, a Nessie lifts her head and scares a lonely tramp, the Dada folk of Portland break the calm by pushing up the Lovejoy ramp. At this point, the poet falls back. There is the chorus faints, and it's the end of the show. But we do have, thank you, but we do have a question to ask. I'm not sure how this is going to work, but you're going to have a conversation, except the only problem is you are totally in the dark. I mean, I can't see anybody, so, you know, if it's disembodied voices, I can deal with it, because I come from a place where the dead are in the majority and they still vote. But, okay, now I can see everybody. Any, yes?
I had a question, or maybe it's just...
What happened to it?
She said, "I'd never give money to an artistic endeavor, you know, I just give it to politics." And it got me thinking that Portland is such a political city, it's such an egalitarian city, that I think it's beginning to smother culture. And I want to know, because you come from Louisiana, I think of being sort of the opposite of Portland, it's sort of got no civic enthusiasm.
Well. No, you're talking about two different things. Now, in New Orleans, we don't smother culture, we chop it to pieces. There is absolutely no support for the arts, because people there think that Mardi Gras is art, and it is. And it's a completely voluntary effort, so there are no, you know, painters and writers have a very hard time there. I think in these communities, you do have more. I mean, I'm not going to get into why, but I think there is quite a bit. Now, as for the business of politics and art, is that, you know, I mean, politics is, you know, an extremely tedious form. Those guys do nothing but repeat themselves endlessly, you know, so you glaze over, you know, if somebody turns you on and makes you feel alive, then you should, you know, give them what they ask for, you know, which is in most cases not much, you know, just enough to, you know, blow it in one night in a week. So. Yes?
You mentioned that you thought Portland was a city with a plan, and I'm curious what your perception of the Portland plan is.
Well, you know, it's admirable to us living in, you know, the savage cities of the South, that there is a place that actually puts aside green spaces for people and creates, you know, downtowns where people can walk around and you have some, you know, real good public transportation. You know, sort of envious of those things. The danger of it, you know, as I sort of said poetically in that work, is that it doesn't leave room for the unpredictable. You can plan too far ahead and you take all the shadows out and then it becomes very, very boring, you know, like all utopias. I mean, nobody really wants to live in paradise. I know that in these churches they promise that, but I lived in a utopia. And it was no good. It's terrible. So you have to allow for the unpredictable, for a very quick response to something like the Lovejoy ramp or something that comes up that's, you know, not predictable, you know, that's strange. And, you know, that's, you know, why, you know, I think every city bureaucrat should be doubled by a poet, you know, or they should live with a poet or, you know, keep a poet as a pet. Poet is just pet without an O, you know. Yes.
How did it happen that you came into public radio?
Well, I went in there with a 45 one day. And I said, you need a Romanian, man. I don't know, I was living in Baltimore and I was writing for the Baltimore Sun, some essays, editorial stuff for the Baltimore Sun, and the local producer at the Baltimore Public Radio Station sent, you know, asked me to tape something and sent it over to a producer at NBR and they liked it. And so I started doing these things and at first they were sort of, they liked them, you know, they were startled, and then they kind of got lulled to sleep by the sound of my voice. And so for years I was able to get away with incredible stuff. And then something happened and they woke up and they said, wait a minute, what are you saying here? So our relationship has been a little tenuous lately, but it's okay. I use T-mail now. But actually they've been remarkable in allowing me to sort of rave on the air for all these years, you know? I mean, it's great to have an accent. You know, and mine, you know, I paid a lot of money for, 'cause you know, I have to talk to my mother every 3 days so she can, you know, fix it. She says, you know, your R's are kind of losing their role, you know. So. Yes.
What are the things that you think will save this country?
From what? From guys like me? What are the things that will save this country? I mean, I don't, you know, see this country as being actually sort of drowning and in immediate danger, you know, so I don't really have a catastrophic view of the present. I mean, I have a catastrophic view of human beings, of my age. But I think this sort of a country is doing fine. I don't think we need to be saved. I mean, we need to be saved from our own arrogance in a certain way and the fact that we feel so good, you know, because feeling good is not great. Feeling good leads to fascism. You know, when people feel really good, they want to march somewhere and beat people up. And that's fascism. It's good to be a little sick. It makes you sensitive. It gives you empathy, you know. So, I mean, an excess of health is what we really need to be saved from. I'll take a couple more, yes. Well, I watched them for about, he wanted to know how I felt about the presidential debates. I watched them for about 30 minutes before I got here, and my impression was that drugs won. They talked about drugs for 30 minutes, you know, and I'm all for drugs, so it sounded like there was no problem there. You know, personally, I don't really like either one of them. I mean, I don't know, it's just sort of visceral, you know, but, you know, I like George Bush less because I kind of smell that oily preacher from Texas in him, you know. I live in Louisiana, so I know, you know, so... It's, you know, I mean, yes. Go ahead. Rhodes Scholar 2. Well, I tried several times to make a Rhodes Scholar 2, but nobody would come up with the money. PBS didn't want to give us any money because they thought I was sort of edgy. And PBS, as you well know, is anything but. You know, so they didn't give us any money. And then I wanted to make a film about the Mississippi River going from Minneapolis, the source, all the way to New Orleans, and doing a story of the political cultures along the shores, at the same time measuring the degradation of the river as it goes down toward the Gulf of Mexico, because it's a great story, you know. It was in the period I was, you know, wrote the treatment for that, some guy running for city council in Minnesota got busted for giving away Twinkies at an old folks home. That's ethics over there. And our governor was giving suitcases full of cash to guys from Vegas in a hotel in downtown New Orleans where he was registered under a false name, you know. And so when they had a public survey, you know, of what people thought about this in the newspaper, they said, well, says, what do you think about your governor giving away suitcases full of cash to guys from Vegas in a downtown hotel where he's registered under a false name? And everybody said, well, if it's his own money. So you have this difference, which doesn't mean that it's more fun to live in Minneapolis than it is to live in New Orleans, because it's more fun to live in New Orleans. And this is, you know, a kind of paradox of, you know, modus vivendi and, you know, and ways that, you know, the political culture and, you know, the other cultures mix, you know. So it would be an interesting study, you know. Yes. Well, I think, I don't know about Portland, people probably here are good because I noticed nobody crosses the street against the light, which is a good thing. But, you know, I don't think that anybody here is not a criminal. I think it's just a matter of not being caught, as somebody told me in a movie when I saw them. So I'm not sure if I could recommend, you know, crimes. I recommend aesthetic enjoyment of one's crimes. You know, self-reflection and, you know, getting the most of the transgression, you know. But I wouldn't recommend borrowing crimes, you know, from the Book of Crimes. But, yeah, of course, you know, I mean, people are nicer here. I know this. People are nicer all the time. I mean, in New Orleans, they're not quite so nice. I mean, they're nice in sort of public intercourse on the street, you know, because they're Southerners. And they can drip honey and stab you in the back in about 12 seconds, but it's different. Okay, well, thank you very much.
That was Andre Codrescu speaking at the Arlene Schitzer Concert Hall in Portland in 2000. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for the Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear this or any other talk in the series, visit literary-arts.org. Crystal Liguori produces the Archive Project for radio and podcast. Special thanks to the literary arts staff, board, and community without whom this show would not be possible. Theme music for the Archive Project is by Emancipator. And thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another edition of the Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.